I really want Rick just one drop of blood.
You don't like that kid, do you? Rick asked.
Junkins uttered a bewildered little laugh.
You know, the first time I kind of did. I liked him and I felt sorry for him. I felt like maybe he was covering for somebody else who had something on him. But this time, I didn't like him at all.
He considered. And I didn't like that car either. The way he kept touching it every time I had him on the ropes, it was spooky.
Rick said, As long as you remember that Darnell is the guy I've got to bust, no one in Harrisburg has the slightest interest in your kid.
I'll remember, Junkins said. He picked up his coffee again and looked at Rick grimly. Because he's a means to the end. I'm going to nail the person who killed those kids if it's the last thing I ever do.
It may not even go down this weekend, Rick said. But it did.
Two plainclothes cops from Pennsylvania's state felony squad sat in the cab of a 4-year-old Datsun pickup on the morning of Saturday, December 16th, watching as Will Darnell's black Chrysler rolled out of the big door and into the street. A light drizzle was falling. It was not quite cold enough to be sleet. It was one of those misty days when it is impossible to tell where the lowering clouds end and the actual mist begins. The Chrysler was quite properly showing its parking lights. Arnie Cunningham was a safe driver. One of the plainclothesmen lifted a walkie-talkie to his mouth and spoke into it.
He just came out in Darnell's car? You guys stay on your toes.
They followed the Chrysler to I-76. When they saw Arnie get on the eastbound ramp with its Harrisburg sign, they turned up the westbound ramp toward Ohio and reported. They would get off I-76 one exit down the line and return to their original position near Darnell's garage.
Okay, Junkins' voice came back. Let's make an omelet.
20 minutes later, as Arnie was cruising east at a sedate and legal 50, three cops with all the right paperwork in hand knocked on the door of William Upshaw, who lived in the very much upscale suburb of Sewickley. Upshaw answered the door in his bathrobe. From behind him came the cartoon squawks of Saturday morning TV.
Who is it, honey?
His wife called from the kitchen. Upshaw looked at the papers, which record orders, and felt that he might faint. One ordered that all of Upshaw's tax records relating to Will Darnell, an individual, and Will Darnell, a corporation, be impounded. These papers bore the signature of the Pennsylvania Attorney General and a Superior Court judge.
Who is it, hon?
His wife asked again, and one of his kids came to look, all big eyes. Upshaw tried to speak and could raise only a dusty croak. It had come. He had dreamed about it, and it had finally come. The house in Sewickley had not protected him from it. The woman he kept at a safe distance in King of Prussia had not protected him from it. It was here. He read it in the smooth faces of these cops, in their off-the-rack Anderson Little suits. Worst of all, one of them was federal. Alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. He produced a second ID, proclaiming him an agent of something called the Federal Drug Control Task Force.
Our information is that you keep an office in your home, the federal cop said. He looked, what, 26, 30?
Had he ever had to worry about what you were going to do when you had three kids and a wife who liked nice things maybe a little too much? Bill Upshaw didn't think so. When you had those things to think about, your face didn't stay that smooth. Your face only stayed that smooth when you could indulge in the luxury of grand thoughts, law and order, right and wrong, good guys and bad guys.
He opened his mouth to answer the federal cop's question and produced only another dusty croak.
Is this information correct? The federal cop asked patiently.
Yes, Bill Upshaw croaked. And another office at 100 Frankstown Road in Monroeville.
Yes.
Hun, who is it?
Amber asked and came into the hallway. She saw the three men standing on the stoop and pulled the neck of her housecoat closed. The cartoons blared. Upshaw thought suddenly, almost with relief, it's the end of everything. The kid who had come out to see who had come to visit so early on a Saturday morning suddenly burst into tears and fled for the safety of the Super Friends on Channel 4. When Rudy Junkins received the news that Upshaw had been served and that all the papers pertaining to Darnell, both at Upshaw's Sewickley home and his Monroeville office, had been impounded, he led half a dozen state cops in what he supposed would have been called a raid in the old days. Even during the holiday season, the garage was moderately busy on Saturday, although it was by no means the bustling place it became on summer weekends. And when Junkins raised a battery-powered loudhailer to his lips and began to use it, perhaps two dozen heads whipped around. They would have conversation enough out of this to last them into the new year. "This is the Pennsylvania State Police," Junkins cried into the loudhailer. The words echoed and bounced. He found, even at this instant, that his eyes were drawn to the white-over-red Plymouth sitting empty in stall 20. He had handled half a dozen murder weapons in his time, sometimes at the scene, more frequently in the witness box, but just looking at that car made him feel cold. Gitney, the IRS man who had come along for this particular sleigh ride, was frowning at him to go on. "None of you know what this is about. None of you." But he raised the loudhailer to his lips again. "This place of business is closed. I repeat, this place of business is closed. You may take your vehicles if they are in running order. If not, please leave quickly and quietly. This place is closed." The loudhailer made an amplified click as he turned it off. He looked toward the office and saw that Will Darnell was talking on the telephone, an unlit cigar jammed in his face. Jimmy Sykes was standing by the Coke machine, his simple face a picture of confused dismay. He didn't look much different from Bill Upshaw's kid at the moment before he burst into tears.
"Do you understand your rights as I have read them to you?" The cop in charge was Rick Mercer. Behind them, the garage was empty except for four uniformed cops who were doing paperwork on the cars which had been impounded when the garage was closed.
"Yeah,"
Will said. His face was composed. The only sign of his upset was his deepening wheeze, the fast rise and fall of his big chest under his open-throated white shirt, the way he held his aspirator constantly in one hand.
"Do you have anything to say to us at this time?" Mercer asked. "Not until my lawyer gets here."
"Your lawyer can meet us in Harrisburg," Junkins said. Will glanced at Junkins contemptuously and said nothing. Outside, more uniformed police had finished affixing seals to every door and window of the garage except for the small side door. Until the state of impound ceased, all traffic would use that door.
"This is the craziest thing I ever heard of,"
Will Darnell said at last.
"It'll get crazier," Mercer said, smiling sincerely. "You're going away for a very long time, Will. Maybe someday they'll put you in charge of the prison motor pool." "I know you," Will said, looking at him. "Your name is Mercer. I knew your father well. He was the crookedest cop that ever came out of Kings County."
The blood fell out of Rick Mercer's face and he raised his hand.
"Stop it, Rick," Junkins said. "Sure," Will said. "You guys have your fun. Make your jokes about the prison motor pool. I'll be back here doing business in 2 weeks, and if you don't know it, you're even stupider than you look."
He glanced around at them, his eyes intelligent, sardonic, and trapped. Abruptly, he raised his aspirator to his mouth and breathed in deeply.
"Get this bag of shit out of here," Mercer said. He was still white.
"You all right?" Junkins asked. They were sitting in an unmarked state Ford half an hour later. The sun had decided to come out and shone blindingly on melting snow and wet streets. Darnell's garage sat silent. Darnell's records and Cunningham's street rod Plymouth were safely penned up inside.
"That crack he made about my father," Mercer said heavily. "My father shot himself, Rudy. Blew his head off. And I always thought, in college, I read..."
He shrugged.
"Lots of cops eat the gun. Melvin Purvis did it, you know. He was the man who got Dillinger. But you wonder."
Mercer lit a cigarette and drew smoke downwards in a long, shuddery breath.
"He didn't know anything," Junkins said. "The fuck he didn't," Mercer said. He unrolled his window and threw the cigarette out. He unclipped the mic under the dash. "Home, this is Mobile 2.
10-4, Mobile 2.
What's happening with our carrier pigeon?"
"He's on Interstate 84, coming up on Port Jervis."
Port Jervis was the crossover point between Pennsylvania and New York.
"New York is already?"
"Affirmative."
You tell them again that I want him northeast of Middletown before they grab him, and his toll ticket taken in evidence.
10-4.
Mercer put the mic back and smiled thinly.
Once he crosses into New York, there's not a question in the world about it being federal. But we've still got first dibs. Isn't that beautiful?
Junkins didn't answer. There was nothing beautiful about it. From Darnell with his aspirator to Mercer's father eating his gun, there was nothing beautiful about it. Junkins was filled with a spooky feeling of inevitability, a feeling that the ugly things were not ending but only just beginning to happen. He felt halfway through a dark story that might prove too terrible to finish, except he had to finish it now, didn't he?
Yes.
The terrible feeling, the terrible image, persisted. That the first time he had talked to Arnie Cunningham, he had been talking to a drowning man. And the second time he had talked to him, the drowning had happened. And he was talking to a corpse. The cloud cover over western New York was breaking, and Arnie's spirits began to rise. It always felt good to get away from Libertyville, away from everything. Not even the knowledge that he had contraband in the trunk could quench that feeling of lift. And at least it wasn't dope this time. Far in the back of his mind, hardly even acknowledged, but there, was the idle speculation about how things would be different. And how his life would change if he just dumped the cigarettes and kept on going. If he just left the entire depressing mess behind. But of course, he wouldn't. Leaving Christine after he had put so much into her was, of course, impossible. He turned up the radio and hummed along with something current. The sun, weakened by December but still trying to be bold, broke cover entirely, and Arnie grinned. He was still grinning when the New York State police car pulled up beside him in the passing lane and paced him. The loudspeaker on top began to chant, "This is for the Chrysler! Pull over, Chrysler, pull over!" Arnie looked over, the grin fading from his lips. He stared into a pair of black sunglasses. Cop glasses. The terror that seized him was deeper than he would have believed any emotion could be, and it wasn't for himself. His mouth went totally dry. His mind went into a blurring overdrive. He saw himself tramping the gas pedal and running for it, and perhaps he would have done it if he had been driving Christine. But he wasn't. He saw Will Darnell telling him that if he got caught holding a bag, it was his bag. Most of all, he saw Junkins, Junkins with his sharp brown eyes, and knew this was Junkins' doing. He wished Rudolph Junkins was dead.
"Pull over, Chrysler. I'm not talking to hear my own voice. Pull over right now."
"Can't say anything," Arnie thought incoherently as he veered over into the breakdown lane. His balls were crawling, his stomach churning madly. He could see his own eyes in the rear view, wall-eyed with fear behind his glasses. Not for him, though. Not for him. Christine. He was afraid for Christine. What they might do to Christine. His panic-stricken mind spun up a kaleidoscope of jumbled images, college application forms with the words "rejected, convicted felon" stamped across them, prison bars, blued steel, a judge bending down from a high bench, his face white and accusing, big bull queers in a prison yard looking for fresh meat, Christine riding the conveyor into the car crusher in the junkyard behind the garage, and then, as he stopped the Chrysler and put it in park, the state police car pulling in behind him, and another, appearing like magic, pulling in ahead of him, a thought came from nowhere, full of cold comfort. Christine can take care of herself. Another thought came as the cops got out and came toward him, one holding a search warrant in his hand. It also seemed to come from nowhere, but it reverberated in Roland D. LeBay's raspy, old man's tones.
"And she'll take care of you, boy. All you gotta do is go on believing in her, and she'll take care of you."
Arnie opened the car door and got out a moment before one of the cops could open it.
"Arnold Richard Cunningham?" one of the cops asked.
"Yes, indeed," Arnie said calmly. "Was I speeding?"
"No, son," one of the others said, "but you are in a world of hurt all the same."
The first cop stepped forward as formally as a career army officer.
"I have a duly executed document here permitting the search of this 1966 Chrysler Imperial in the name of the people of New York State and of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and of the United States of America. Further..."
"Well, that just about covers the motherfucking waterfront, doesn't it?" Arnie said.
His back flared dully, and he jammed his hands against it. The cop's eyes widened slightly at the old voice coming out of this kid. But then he went on. "Further to seize any contraband found in the course of this search in the name of the people of New York State and of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and of the United States of America."
"Fine,"
Arnie said. None of it seemed real. Blue lights flashed, a confusion. People passing in their cars turned to look, but he found he had no desire to turn from them, to hide his face, and that was something of a relief.
"Give me their keys, kid," one of the cops said. "Why don't you just get them yourself, you shitter?"
Arnie said.
"You're not helping yourself, kiddo," the cop said,
but he looked startled and a little fearful all the same. For a moment, the kid's voice had deepened and roughened, and he had sounded 40 years older and a pretty tough customer, nothing like the skinny kid he saw before him at all. He leaned in, got the keys, and three of the cops immediately headed for the trunk.
"They know," Arnie thought,
resigned. At least this had nothing to do with Junkins's obsession with Buddy Repperton and Moochie Welch and the others. At least not directly, he amended cautiously. This smelled like a well-planned and well-coordinated operation against Will's smuggling operations from Libertyville into New York and New England.
"Kid," one of the cops said, "would you like to answer some questions or make a statement? If you think you would, I'll read you the Miranda right now."
"Nah,"
Arnie said calmly.
"I don't have anything to say."
"Things could go a lot easier with you."
"That's coercion,"
Arnie said, smiling a little.
"Watch out or you'll put a big fat hole in your own case."
The cop flushed.
"If you want to be an asshole, that's your lookout."
The Chrysler trunk was open. They had pulled out the spare tire, the jack, and several boxes of small parts, springs, nuts, bolts, and the like. One of the cops was almost entirely in the trunk, only his blue-gray clad legs stuck out. For a moment, Arnie hoped vaguely that they wouldn't find the undercompartment. Then he dismissed the thought. It was just the childish part of him, the part he now wished burned away, because all that part of him did lately was hurt. They would find it. The quicker they found it, the quicker this nasty roadside scene would end. As if some god had heard his wish and decided to grant it post-haste, the cop in the trunk called triumphantly,
"Cigarettes!"
"All right,"
the cop who had read the warrant said. "Close it up." He turned to Arnie and read him the Miranda warning.
"Do you understand your rights as I have read them to you?"
"Yes,"
Arnie said.
"Do you want to make a statement?"
"No."
"Get in the car, son. You're under arrest."
"I'm under arrest," Arnie thought, and almost brayed laughter. The thought was so foolish. This was all a dream, and he would wake up soon, under arrest, being hustled to a state police cruiser, people looking at him, desperate, childish tears, hot salt welled up in his throat and closed it, his chest hitched, once, twice. The cop who had read him his rights touched his shoulder, and Arnie shrugged it off with a kind of desperation. He felt that if he could get deep down inside himself quickly enough, he would be okay, but sympathy might drive him mad.
"Don't touch me!"
"You do it the way you want to do it, son," the cop said, removing his hand.
He opened the cruiser's rear door for Arnie and handed him in. Do you cry in dreams? Of course you could. Hadn't he read about people waking up from sad dreams with tears on their cheeks? But dream or no dream, he wasn't going to cry. Instead, he would think of Christine. Not of his mother or father, not of Lee or Will Darnell, not of Slauson, all the miserable shitters who had betrayed him, he would think of Christine. Arnie closed his eyes and leaned his pale, gaunt face forward into his hands and did just that. And as always, thinking about Christine made things better. After a while, he was able to straighten up and look out at the passing scenery and think about his position. Michael Cunningham put the telephone back into its cradle slowly, with infinite care, as if to do less might cause it to explode and spray his upstairs study with jagged black hooks of shrapnel. He sat back in the swivel chair behind his desk, on which there sat his IBM correcting Selectric 2 typewriter, an ashtray with the blue and gold legend Horlicks University barely legible across the dirty bottom, and the manuscript of his third book, a study of the ironclads Monitor and Merrimack. He had been halfway through a page when the telephone rang.
Now he flipped the paper release on the right side of the typewriter and pulled the page bonelessly out from under the roller, observing its slight curve clinically. He put it down on top of the manuscript, which was now little more than a jungle of penciled-in corrections. Outside, a cold wind whined around the house. The morning's cloudy warmth had given way to a frigid, clear December evening. The earlier melt had frozen tight, and his son was being held in Albany on charges of what amounted to smuggling.
"No, Mr. Cunningham, it is not marijuana. It is cigarettes. 200 cartons of Winston cigarettes with no tax stamps."
From downstairs, he could hear the whir of Regina's sewing machine. He would have to get up now, go to the door and open it, go down the hall to the stairs, walk down the stairs, walk into the dining room, then into the plant-lined little room that had once been a laundry, but which was now a sewing room, and stand there while Regina looked up at him. She would be wearing her half-glasses for the close work, and say, "Regina, Arnie has been arrested by the New York State Police." Michael attempted to begin this process by getting up from his desk chair, but the chair seemed to sense he was temporarily off guard. It swiveled and rolled backward on its casters at the same moment, and Michael had to clutch the edge of his desk to keep from falling. He slipped heavily back into the chair, heart thudding with painful rapidity in his chest. He was struck suddenly by such a complex wave of despair and sorrow that he groaned aloud and grabbed his forehead, squeezing his temples. The old thoughts swarmed back in, as predictable as summer mosquitoes and just as maddening. 6 months ago, things had been okay. Now his son was sitting in a jail cell somewhere. What were the watershed moments? How could he, Michael, have changed things? What was the history of it exactly? Where had the sickness started to creep in?
Jesus.
He squeezed harder, listening to the winter whine outside the windows. He and Arnie had put the storms on just last month. That had been a good day, hadn't it? First Arnie holding the ladder and looking up, then him down and Arnie up there, him shouting for Arnie to be careful, the wind in his hair and dead brown leaves blowing over his shoes, their colors gone. Sure, it had been a good day. Even after that beastly car had come, seeming to overshadow everything in their son's life like a fatal disease, there had been some good days. Hadn't there?
Jesus,
he said again, in a weak, teary voice that he despised. Unbidden images rose behind his eyes, colleagues looking at him sideways, maybe whispering in the faculty club. Discussions at cocktail parties in which his name bobbed uneasily up and down like a waterlogged body. Arnie wouldn't be 18 for almost 2 months, and he supposed that meant his name wouldn't be printed in the paper, but everyone would still know. Word got around. Suddenly, crazily, he saw Arnie at 4, astride a red trike he and Regina had gotten at a rummage sale. Arnie at 4 had called them Mama's Rubbage Sales. The trike's red paint was flaked with scales of rust, the tires were bald, but Arnie had loved it. He would have taken that trike to bed with him if he could. Michael closed his eyes and saw Arnie riding up and down the sidewalk, wearing his blue corduroy jumper, his hair flopping in his eyes, and then his mind's eye blinked or wavered or did something, and the rusty rubbish sale trike was Christine, her red paint scummed with rust, her windows milky white with age. He gritted his teeth together. Someone looking in might have thought he was smiling crazily. He waited until he had some kind of control, and then he got up and went downstairs to tell Regina what had happened. He would tell her, and she would think of what they were going to do, just as she always had. She would steal the forward motion from him, taking whatever sorry balm that actually doing things had to give, and leave him with only sick sorrow, and the knowledge that now his son was someone else.
Chapter 41, The Coming of the Storm. The first of that winter's great northeast storms came to Libertyville on Christmas Eve, beating its way across the upper third of the U.S. on a wide and easily predictable storm track. The day began in bright 30-degree sunshine, But morning DJs were already cheerfully predicting doom and gloom, urging those who had not finished their last-minute shopping to do so by mid-afternoon. Those planning trips to the old homestead for an old-fashioned Christmas were urged to rethink their plans if the trip could not be made in 4 to 6 hours.
If you don't want to be spending Christmas Day in the breakdown lane of I-76 somewhere between Bedford and Carlisle, I'd leave early or not at all, the FM 104 jock advised his listening audience, a large part of which was too stoned to even consider going anyplace, and then resumed the Christmas block party with Springsteen's version of Santa Claus is Coming to Town. By 11 a.m., when Dennis Gilder finally left Libertyville Community Hospital, as per hospital regulations, he was not allowed on his crutches until he was actually out of the building. Until then, he was pushed along in a wheelchair by Elaine. The sky had begun to scum over with clouds, and there was an eerie fairy ring around the sun. Dennis crossed the parking lot carefully on his crutches, his mother and father bookending him nervously, in spite of the fact that the lot had been scrupulously salted free of even the slightest trace of snow and ice. He paused by the family car, turning his face up slightly into the freshening breeze. Being outside was like a resurrection. He felt he could stand here for hours and not have enough of it. By 1 o'clock that afternoon, the Cunningham family station wagon had reached the outskirts of Ligonier, 90 miles east of Libertyville. The sky had gone a smooth and pregnant slate gray by this time, and the temperature had dropped 6 degrees. It had been Arnie's idea that they not cancel the traditional Christmas Eve visit with Aunt Vicky and Uncle Steve, Regina's sister and her husband. The two families had created a casual, loosely rotating ritual over the years, with Vicky and Steve coming to their house some years, the Cunninghams going over to Ligonier on others. This year's trip had been arranged in early December. It had been canceled after what Regina stubbornly called Arnie's trouble. But at the beginning of last week, Arnie had begun restlessly agitating for the trip. At last, after a long telephone conversation with her sister on Wednesday, Regina gave in to Arnie's wish, mostly because Vicky had seemed calm and understanding, and most of all, not very curious about what had happened. That was important to Regina, more important than she would perhaps ever be able to say. It seemed to her that in the 8 days since Arnie had been arrested in New York, she had had to cope with a seemingly endless flood of rancid curiosity, masquerading as sympathy. Talking to Vicky on the telephone, she had finally broken down and cried. It was the first and only time since Arnie had been arrested in New York that she had allowed herself that bitter luxury. Arnie had been in bed asleep. Michael, who was drinking much too much and passing it off as the spirit of the season, had gone down to O'Malley's for a beer or two with Paul Strickland, another factory reject in the game of faculty politics. It would probably end up being 6 beers, or 8, or 10. And if she went upstairs to his study later on, she would find him sitting bolt upright behind his desk, looking out into the dark, his eyes dry, but bloodshot. If she tried to speak with him, his conversation would be horribly confused and centered too much in the past. She supposed her husband might be having a very quiet mental breakdown. She would not allow herself the same luxury, for so in her own hurt and angry state she thought it. And every night her mind ticked and whirred with plans and schemes until 3 or 4 o'clock. All these thoughts and schemes were aimed at one end, getting us over this. The only two ways she would allow her mind to approach what had happened were deliberately vague. She thought about Arnie's trouble and getting us over this. But, talking to Vicky on the phone a few days after her son's arrest, Regina's iron control had wavered briefly. She cried on Vicky's shoulder long distance, and Vicky had been calmly comforting, making Regina hate herself for all the cheap shots she had taken at Vicky over the years. Vicky, whose only daughter had dropped out of junior college to get married and become a housewife, whose only son had been content with a vocational technical school. None of that for her son, Regina had thought with a private exultation. Vicky, whose husband sold, of all hilarious things, life insurance. And Vicky, hilariouser and hilariouser, sold Tupperware. But it was Vicky she had been able to cry to. It had been Vicky to whom she had been able to express at least part of her tortured sense of disappointment and terror and hurt. Yes, and the terrible embarrassment of it.
of knowing that people were talking, and that people who had for years wanted to see her take a fall were now satisfied. It was Vicky. Maybe it had always been Vicky. And Regina decided that if there was to be a Christmas at all for them this miserable year, it would be at Vicky and Steve's ordinary suburban ranch house in the amusingly middle-class suburb of Ligonier, where most people still owned American cars and called a trip to McDonald's eating out. Mike, of course, simply went along with her decision. She would have expected no more and brooked no less. For Regina Cunningham, the 3 days following the news that Arnie was in trouble had been an exercise in pure, cold control, a hard lunge for survival. Her survival, the family's survival, Arnie's survival. He might not believe that, but Regina found she hadn't the time to care. Mike's pain had never entered her equations. The thought that they could comfort each other had never even crossed her mind as a speculation. She had calmly put the cover on her sewing machine after Mike came downstairs and gave her the news. She did that, and then she had gone to the phone and had gotten to work. The tears she would later shed while talking to her sister had then been 1,000 years away. She had brushed past Michael as if he were a piece of furniture, and he had trailed uncertainly after her as he had done all of their married life. She called Tom Sprague, their lawyer, who, hearing that their problem was criminal, hastily referred her to a colleague, Jim Warburg. She called Warburg and got an answering service that would not reveal Warburg's home number. She sat by the phone for a moment, drumming her fingers lightly against her lips, and then called their family lawyer back. Sprague hadn't wanted to give her Warburg's home telephone number, but in the end, he gave in. When Regina finally let him go, Sprague sounded dazed, almost shell-shocked. Regina, in full spate, often caused such a reaction. She called Warburg, who said he absolutely couldn't take the case. Regina had lowered her bulldozer blade again. Warburg ended up not only taking the case, but agreeing to go immediately to Albany, where Arnie was being held, to see what could be done. Warburg, speaking in the weak, amazed voice of a man who has been filled full of Novocaine and then run over by a tractor, protested that he knew a perfectly good man in Albany who could get the lay of the land. Regina was adamant. Warburg went by private plane and reported back 4 hours later. Arnie, he said, was being held on an open charge. He would be extradited to Pennsylvania the following day. Pennsylvania and New York had coordinated the bust along with 3 federal agencies, the Federal Drug Control Task Force, the IRS, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The main target was not Arnie, who was small beans, but Will Darnell. Darnell and whomever Darnell was doing business with. Those guys, Warburg said, with their suspected ties to organized crime and disorganized drug smuggling in the New South, were the big beans. Holding someone on an open charge is illegal, Regina had snapped immediately, drawing on a deep backlog of TV crime show fare. Warburg, not exactly overjoyed to be where he was when he had planned on spending a quiet evening at home reading a book, rejoined crisply, "I'd be down on my knees thanking God that's what they're doing. They caught him with a trunkload of unstamped cigarettes, and if I push them on it, they'll be more than happy to charge him, Mrs. Cunningham. I advise you and your husband to get over here to Albany, quickly."
"I thought you said he was going to be extradited tomorrow."
"Oh, yes, that's all been arranged. If we've got to play hardball with these guys, we ought to be glad the game's going to be played on our home court. Extradition isn't the problem here."
"What is?"
"These people want to play knock over the dominoes. They want to knock your son over onto Will Darnell. Arnold is not talking. I want you two to get over here and persuade him that it's in his best interest to talk."
"Is it?" she had asked, hesitantly.
"Hell yes," Warburg's voice crackled back. "These guys don't want to put your son in jail. He's a minor from a good family with no previous criminal record, not even a school record of disciplinary problems. He can get out of this without even facing a judge, but he's got to talk."
So they had gone to Albany, and Regina had been taken down a short, narrow hallway faced in white tile, lit with high-intensity bulbs, sunken into small wells in the ceiling and covered with wire mesh. The place had smelled vaguely of Lysol and urine, and she kept trying to convince herself that her son was being held here. Her son! But achieving that conviction was a hard go. It didn't seem possible that it could be true. The possibility that it was all a hallucination seemed much more likely. Seeing Arnie had stripped away that possibility in a hurry. The protective jacket of shock was likewise stripped away, and she felt a cold, consuming fear. It was at this moment that she had first seized on the idea of getting us over this, the way a drowning person will seize a life preserver. It was Arnie. It was her son. Not in a jail cell. That was the only thing she had been spared, but she was grateful for even small favors. But in a small square room whose only furnishings were two chairs and a table scarred with cigarette burns. Arnie had looked at her steadily, and his face seemed horribly gaunt, skull-like. He had been to the barber only a week before and had gotten a surprisingly short haircut, after years of wearing it long in emulation of Dennis. And now the overhead light shone down cruelly through what was left, making him appear momentarily bald, as if they had shaved his head to loosen his lips. "Arnie," she said, and went to him, halfway to him. He turned his head away from her, his lips pressing together, and she stopped. A lesser woman might have burst into tears then, but Regina was not a lesser woman. She let the coldness come back and have its way with her. The coldness was all that would help now. Instead of embracing him, something he obviously didn't want, she sat down and told him what had to be done. He refused. She ordered him to talk to the police. He refused again. She reasoned with him. He refused. She harangued him. He refused. She pleaded with him. He refused. Finally, she just sat there, dully, a headache thudding at her temples, and asked him why. He refused to tell her. "I thought you were smart," she shouted, finally. She was nearly mad with frustration. The thing she hated above all others was not getting her way when she absolutely wanted to have it, needed to have it. This had, in fact, never happened to her since she left home. Until now. It was infuriating to be so smoothly and seamlessly balked by this boy who had once drawn milk from her breasts. "I thought you were smart, but you're stupid. You're an asshole. They'll put you in jail. Do you want to go to jail for that man, Darnell? Is that what you want? He'll laugh at you. He'll laugh at you." Regina could imagine nothing worse, and her son's apparent lack of interest in whether or not he was laughed at infuriated her all the more. She rose from her chair and pushed her hair away from her brow and eyes, the unconscious gesture of a person who is ready to fight. She was breathing rapidly, and her face was flushed. To Arnie, she looked both younger and much, much older than he had ever seen her.
"I'm not doing it for Darnell," he said quietly. "And I'm not going to jail."
"What are you, Oliver Wendell Holmes?" she rejoined fiercely, but her anger was in some measure overmastered by relief. At least he could say something. "They caught you in his car with the trunk loaded with cigarettes, illegal cigarettes." Mildly, Arnie said,
"They weren't in the trunk. They were in a compartment under the trunk, a secret compartment, and it was Will's car. Will told me to take his car."
She looked at him. "Are you saying you didn't know they were there?" Arnie looked at her with an expression she simply couldn't accept. It was so foreign to his face. It was contempt. "Good as gold. My boy's as good as gold," she thought crazily.
"I knew, and Will knew. But they have to prove it, don't they?"
She could only look at him, amazed.
"If they do drop it on me somehow," he said, "I'll get a suspended sentence."
"Arnie," she said at last, "you're not thinking straight. Maybe your father..."
"Yes," he interrupted. "I'm thinking straight. I don't know what you're doing, but I'm thinking very straight."
And he looked at her, his gray eyes so horribly blank that she could no longer stand it and had to leave. In the small green reception room, she walked blindly past her husband, who had been sitting on a bench with Warburg. "You go in," she said. "You make him see reason." She went on without waiting for his reply, not stopping until she was outside and the cold December air was painting her hot cheeks. Michael went in and had no better luck. He came out with nothing more than a dry throat and a face that looked 10 years older than it had going in. At the motel, Regina told Warburg what Arnie had said and asked him if there was any chance he might be right. Warburg looked thoughtful.
Yes, that's a possible defense, he said. But it would be a hell of a lot more possible if Arnie was the first domino in line. He's not. There's a used car dealer here in Albany named Henry Buck. He was the catcher. He's been arrested, too.
What has he said? Michael asked.
I have no way of knowing, but when I tried to speak to his lawyer, he declined to speak with me. I find that ominous. If Buck talks, he puts the onus on Arnie. I'll bet you my house and lot that Buck can testify your son knew that secret compartment was there, and that's bad.
Warburg looked at them closely.
You see, what your boy said to you is really only half smart, Mrs. Cunningham. I'll be talking to him tomorrow, before they move him back to Pennsylvania. What I hope to make him see is that there's a possibility this whole thing could come down on his head.
The first flakes of snow began to swirl out of the heavy sky as they turned onto Steve and Vicky Street.
Is it snowing in Libertyville yet?
Arnie wondered, and touched the keys on their leather tab in his pocket. Probably it was. Christine was still in Darnell's garage, impounded. That was all right. At least she was out of the weather. He would pick her up again. In time. The previous weekend was like a blurred bad dream. His parents, haranguing him in the little white room, had seemed to bear the disconnected faces of strangers. They were heads talking in a foreign language. The lawyer they had hired, Worley or Wormley or whatever, kept talking about something he called the domino theory and about the need to get out of the condemned building before the whole thing falls down on your head, boy. There are 2 states and 3 federal agencies bringing up the wrecking balls. But Arnie was more worried about Christine. It seemed clearer and clearer to him that Roland D. LeBay was either with him or hovering someplace near. He was perhaps coalescing inside him. This idea did not frighten Arnie. It comforted him. But he had to be careful. Not of Junkins. He felt that Junkins had only suspicions, and that they all lay in wrong directions, radiating out from Christine rather than in toward her. But Darnell? There could be problems with Will. Yes, real problems. That first night in Albany, after his mother and father had gone back to their motel, Arnie had been conducted to a holding cell, where he had fallen asleep with surprising ease and speed. And he had had a dream. Not quite a nightmare, but something that seemed terribly disquieting. He had awakened watchfully in the middle of the night, his body running with sweat. He had dreamed that Christine had been reduced in scale to a tiny 58 Plymouth, no longer than a man's hand. It was on a slot car track, surrounded by HO-scale scenery that was amazingly apt. Here was a plastic street that could be Basin Drive. Here was another that could be JFK Drive, where Moochie Welch had been killed. A Lego building that looked exactly like Libertyville High, plastic houses, paper trees. And a gigantic, hulking Will Darnell was at the controls that dictated how fast or how slowly the tiny fury ran through all of this. His breath wheezed in and out of his damaged lungs with a windstorm sound.
"You don't want to open your mouth, kiddo," Will said.
He loomed over this scale-model world like the amazing colossal man.
"You don't want to frig with me because I'm in control. I can do this."
And slowly, Will began to turn the control knob over toward fast.
No! Arnie tried to scream. No, don't do that, please! I love her, please! You'll kill her!
On the track, the tiny Christine raced through the tiny Libertyville faster and faster, her rear end switching on the curves as she shimmied on the far edge of centrifugal force, that dish-shaped mystery. Now she was simply a blur of white over red, her engine a high, angry wasp whine. Please, Arnie screamed. Please! At last, Will had begun to turn the control back, looking grimly pleased. The little car began to slow down.
If you start to get ideas, you just want to remember where your car is, kiddo. Keep your mouth shut, and we'll both live to fight another day. I've been in tighter jams than this.
Arnie had reached out to grasp the little car, to rescue it from the track. The dream Will had slapped his hand away.
Whose bag is it, kiddo?
Will, please.
Let me hear you say it.
It's my bag.
Just remember it, kiddo.
And Arnie had awakened with that in his ears. There had been no more sleep for him that night. Was it so unlikely that Will would know, well, would know something about Christine. No, he saw a great deal from behind that window, but he knew how to keep his mouth shut, at least until the time was right to open it. He might know what Junkins did not, that Christine's regeneration in November was not just strange, but totally impossible. He would know that a lot of the repairs had never been made, at least not by Arnie. What else would he know? With a creeping coldness that moved up his legs to the root of his guts, Arnie realized at last that Will could have been at the garage the night Repperton and the others had died. In fact, it was more than possible. It was probable. Jimmy Sykes was simple, and Will didn't like to trust him alone.
You don't want to open your mouth. You don't want to frig with me because I can do this.
But even supposing Will knew, who would believe him? It was too late for self-delusion now, and Arnie could no longer put the unthinkable thought away from himself. He no longer even wanted to. Who would believe Will if Will decided to tell someone that Christine sometimes ran by herself, that she had been out on her own the night Moochie Welch was killed and the night those other hoods were killed? Would the police believe that? They would laugh themselves into a hemorrhage. Junkins getting warmer, but Arnie didn't believe Junkins would be able to accept such a thing even if he wanted to. Arnie had seen his eyes, so even if Will did know, what good would his knowledge do? Then, with mounting horror, Arnie realized that it didn't matter. Will would be out on bail tomorrow or the next day, and then Christine would be his hostage. He could torch it. He had torched plenty of cars in his time, as Arnie knew from sitting in the office and listening to him yarn. And after she was torched, a burned hulk, helpless, there was the crusher out back. In goes the cindered hulk of Christine on the conveyor belt. Out comes a smashed cube of metal. The cops have sealed the place, but that didn't cut any ice either. Will Darnell was a very old fox, and he stayed prepared for any contingency. If Will wanted to get in and torch Christine, he would do it. Although it was much more likely, Arnie thought, that he would hire an insurance specialist to do the job. A guy who would throw double handfuls of charcoal lighter cubes into the car and then toss a match. In his mind's eye, Arnie could see the blossoming flames. He could smell charring upholstery. He lay on the cell bunk, his mouth dry, his heart beating rapidly in his chest.
You don't want to open your mouth. You don't want to frig with me.
Of course, if Will tried something and got careless, if his concentration lapsed for even a moment, Christine would get him. But somehow Arnie didn't think Will would get careless. The next day he had been taken back to Pennsylvania, charged, then bailed for a nominal sum. There would be a preliminary hearing in January, and there was already talk of a grand jury. The bust was front-page material across the state, although Arnie was only identified as a youth, whose name was being withheld by state and federal authorities due to his minor status. Arnie's name was common enough knowledge in Libertyville, however. In spite of its new exurban sprawl of drive-ins, fast-food emporiums, and bowl-o-ramas, it was still a faculty town, where a lot of people were living in other people's back pockets. These people, mostly associated with Horlicks University, knew who had been driving for Will Darnell and who had been arrested over the New York state line with a trunk full of contraband cigarettes. It was Regina's nightmare. Arnie went home in the custody of his parents, bailed for $1,000 after a brief detour to jail. It was all nothing but a big shitting game of Monopoly, really. His parents had come up with the get-out-of-jail-free card, as expected.
"What are you smiling about, Arnie?"
Regina asked him. Michael was driving the wagon along at fast walking speed, looking through the swirls of snow for Steve and Vicky's ranch house.
"Was I smiling?"
"Yes," she said, and touched his hair.
"I don't really remember,"
he said remotely, and she took her hand away. They had come home on Sunday, and his parents had left him pretty much alone, either because they didn't know how to talk to him, or because they were utterly disgusted with him. Or perhaps it was a combination of the two. He didn't give a crap which, and that was the truth. He felt washed out, exhausted, a ghost of himself. His mother had gone to bed and slept all that afternoon, after taking the telephone off the hook. His father puttered aimlessly in his workroom, running his electric planer periodically, and then shutting it off. Arnie sat in the living room, watching a football playoff doubleheader, not knowing who was playing, not caring, content to watch the players run around, first in bright, warm California sunshine, later in a mixture of rain and sleet that turned the playing field to churned up mud and erased the lines. Around 6 o'clock, he dozed off and dreamed. He dreamed again that night and the next, in the bed where he had slept since earliest childhood, the elm outside casting its old, familiar shadow, a skeleton each winter that gained miraculous new flesh each May. These dreams were not like the dream of the giant Will looming over the slot car track. He could not remember these dreams at all, more than a few moments after waking. Perhaps that was just as well. A figure by the roadside, a fleshless finger tapping a decayed palm in a lunatic parody of instruction, an uneasy sense of freedom and... escape? Yes. Escape. Nothing else except... yes, he escaped from these dreams and back into reality with one repeating image. He was behind the wheel of Christine, driving slowly through a howling blizzard, snow so thick that he could literally see no farther than the end of her hood. The wind was not a scream, it was a lower, more sinister sound, a basso roar. Then the image had changed. The snow wasn't snow any longer, it was ticker tape. The roar of the wind was the roar of a great crowd lining both sides of Fifth Avenue. They were cheering him, they were cheering Christine, they were cheering because he and Christine had escaped. Each time this confused dream retreated, he thought, when this is over, I'm getting out. Getting out for sure. Going to drive to Mexico. And Mexico, as he imagined, its steady sun and its rural quiet, seemed more real than the dreams. Shortly after awakening from the last of these dreams, the idea of spending Christmas with Aunt Vicky and Uncle Steve, just like in the old days, had come to him. He awoke with it, and it clanged in his head with a peculiar persistence. The idea seemed to be an awfully good one, an all-important one, to get out of Libertyville before, well, before Christmas. What else? So he began talking to his mother and father about it, coming down particularly hard on Regina. On Wednesday, she abruptly gave in and agreed. He knew she had talked to Vicky, and Vicky hadn't been inclined to lord it over her. So it was all right. Now, on Christmas Eve, he felt that everything would soon be all right. "There it is, Mike," Regina said, "and you're going to drive right by it just like you do every time we come here." Michael grunted and turned into the driveway. "I saw it," he said, in the perpetually defensive tone he always seemed to use around his wife. "He's a donkey," Arnie thought. "She talks to him like a donkey, she rides him like a donkey, and he brays like a donkey."
"You're smiling again," Regina said.
"I was just thinking about how much I love you both," Arnie said.
His father looked at him, surprised and touched. There was a soft gleam in his mother's eyes that might have been tears.
They really believed it.
The shitters.
By 3 o'clock that Christmas Eve, the snow was still only isolated flurries, although the flurries were beginning to blend into each other. The delay in the storm's arrival was not good news, the weather forecasters said. It had compacted itself and turned even more vicious. Predictions of possible accumulations had gone from a foot to a possible 18 inches, with serious drifting and high winds. Lee Cabot sat in the living room of her house, across from a small, natural Christmas tree that was already beginning to shed its needles. In her house, she was the voice of traditionalism, and for 4 years had successfully staved off her father's wish for a synthetic tree, and her mother's wish to kick off the holiday season with a goose or a capon instead of the traditional Thanksgiving turkey. She was alone in the house. Her mother and father had gone over to the Stewarts for Christmas Eve drinks. Mr. Stewart was her father's new boss, and they liked each other. This was a friendship Mrs. Cabot was eager to promote. In the last 10 years, they had moved 6 times, hopping all over the eastern seaboard, and of all the places they had been, her mom liked Libertyville the best. She wanted to stay here, and her husband's friendship with Mr. Stewart could go a long way toward ensuring that.
"All alone and still a virgin," she thought.
That was an utterly stupid thing to think, but all the same, she got up suddenly, as if stung. She went into the kitchen, overconscious of that Formica Wonderland's little servo sounds. Electric clock, the oven where a ham was baking. Turn that off at 5 if they're not back, she reminded herself. A cool clunk from the freezer as the Frigidaire's ice maker made another cube. She opened the fridge, saw a six-pack of Coke sitting in there next to Daddy's beer, and thought, "Get thee behind me, Satan." Then she grabbed a can anyway. Never mind what it did to her complexion. She wasn't going with anyone now. If she broke out, so what? The empty house made her uneasy. It never had before. She had always felt pleased and absurdly competent when they left her alone. A holdover from childhood days, no doubt. The house had always seemed comforting to her. But now the sounds of the kitchen, of the rising wind outside, even the scuff of her slippers on the linoleum, those sounds seemed sinister, even frightening. If things had worked out differently, Arnie could have been here with her. Her folks, especially her mother, had liked him. At first. Now, of course, after what had happened, her mother would probably wash her mouth out with soap if she knew Lee was even thinking of him. But she did think of him. Too much of the time. Wondering why he had changed. Wondering how he was taking the breakup. Wondering if he was okay. The wind rose to a shriek, and then fell off a little, reminding her, for no reason, of course, of a car's engine revving. And then falling off. Her mind whispered strangely. And for no reason at all, of course, she went to the sink and poured her Coke down the drain and wondered if she was going to cry, or throw up, or what. She realized with dawning surprise that she was in a state of low terror. For no reason at all, of course. At least her parents had left the car in the garage. Cars. She had cars on the brain. She didn't like to think of her dad trying to drive home from the Stewarts in this, half-soused from 3 or 4 martinis, except that he always called them martoonies, with typical adult kittenishness. It was only 3 blocks, and the 2 of them had left the house bundled up and giggling, looking like a couple of large children on their way to make a snowman. The walk home would sober them up. It would be good for them. It would be good for them if... The wind rose again. Gunning around the eaves and then falling off, and she suddenly saw her mother and father walking up the street through clouds of blowing snow, holding on to each other to keep from falling on their drunken, lovable asses, laughing. Daddy may be goosing Mom through her snow pants. The way he sometimes goosed her when he got a buzz on was also something that had always irritated Lee, precisely because it seemed such a juvenile thing for a grown man to do. But of course, she loved them both. Her love was a part of the irritation, and her occasional exasperation with them was very much a part of her love. They were walking together through a snow as thick as heavy smoke, and then 2 huge green eyes opened in the white behind them, seeming to float, eyes that looked terribly like the circles of the dashboard instruments she had seen as she was choking to death, and they were growing, stalking her helpless, laughing, squiffy parents. She drew a harsh breath and went back into the living room. She approached the telephone, almost touched it, then veered away and went back to the window, looking out into the white and cupping her elbows in the palms of her hands. What had she been about to do? Call them? Tell them she was alone in the house and had gotten to thinking about Arnie's old and somehow slinking car, his steel girlfriend Christine, and that she wanted them to come home because she was scared for them and herself? Was that what she was going to do? Cutely. Cute. The plowed blacktop of the street was disappearing under new snow, but slowly. It had only just begun to snow really hard, and the wind periodically tried to clear the street with strong gusts that sent membranes of powder twisting and rising to merge with the whitish-gray sky of this stormy afternoon, like slowly twisting smoke ghosts. Oh, but the terror was there. It was real. And something was going to happen. She knew it. She had been shocked to hear that Arnie had been arrested for smuggling, but that reaction had been nowhere as strong as the sick fear she had felt when she opened the paper on an earlier day and saw what had happened to Buddy Repperton and those other 2 boys. That day when her first crazy, terrible, and somehow certain thought had been Christine. and now the premonition of some new piece of black work hung heavily on her, and she couldn't get rid of it. It was crazy. Arnie had been in Philadelphia at a chess tourney. She had asked around that day. That was all there was to it, and she would not think about this anymore. She would turn on all the radios, the TV, fill up the house with sound, not think about that car that smelled like the grave, that car that had tried to kill her, murder her. Oh, damn, she whispered. Can't you quit? Her arms sculpted rigidly in goose flesh. Abruptly, she went to the telephone again.